After working a few years as an assistant film editor, I decided to try to make the jump to editor. The decision wasn't so much an if as a when. I knew I didn't want to be an assistant forever, or even for very much longer. Although I had increased my knowledge and ability in the cutting room, I found the actual work of an assistant editor extremely boring, if not downright demeaning. Keeping track of the millions of tiny pieces of plastic generated during the cutting of a film is a monumental and monumentally tedious task, and I got into editing because I like putting things together and trying to make them work, taking A and B and making a wholly different C out of it. Assisting an editor was just not cutting it. Plus, there's a precarious balance that needs to be maintained on the road to editorship. It really does make you a better editor if you spend some time assisting and immersing yourself in the arcana of opticals and negative cutting and drop frames and delivery requirements, but if you spend too much time honing your skills as an assistant, you'll be branded an assistant forever. The ladder to editor, although closely linked with the assistant ladder, is a separate structure, and when you are ready to try to make the jump, you have to start over again from near zero. So, not only are you in danger of becoming a permanent assistant if you stay on the job too long, but it's also quite possible to become too comfortable with the money that a good assistant can make to be able to retighten the belt and take the hit that building your new career takes on your income. I've seen it happen to several people. Not wanting to fall into that trap, I jumped to the bottom rung of the editor's ladder as soon as I could. And the bottom was pretty far down, I dare say. My first chance to edit something was when the editor I was assisting got another job before finishing the last one. That means I got to take over the reins on the absurd and absurdly named Tough and Deadly. There's not a street that you can walk. Which always reminds me of the local LA chain of stores, Smart and Final. The director had been fired from the show the same week that the editor had to leave, so my first day of actually touching the flatbed cam editing machine was under the eye of the new director, brought in to pump up the film and add some new scenes. I have rarely been so scared, and my nerves betrayed me as I tried to make a change to a sequence, spent 20 minutes pulling it all apart, and then put it all back together exactly the same way it was when I started. Trying to learn to keep the film in sync while I made changes to somebody else's cut was murderously difficult, but I persevered and eventually got more comfortable with the tricks of cutting film on a flatbed. The producers of that film loved me. They were especially glad to be rid of the previous editor because, in their opinion, all of the temporary music he put in the rough cut sucked, and they thought he really didn't have the right feel for the film. I never mentioned to them that he had come to me looking for music suggestions, and I had been the one that convinced him to use the pieces he used. The film got finished, for better or worse, and the company promptly went out of business. The editor also left on my next job, this time considerably earlier in the film, due to the oft-cited creative differences between her and the director, so I got bumped up to editor on that film. That was a much better experience, and the film, a documentary about Ayn Rand, was much more agreeable to work on. I may not have agreed with the subject's philosophy, but I wasn't embarrassed to be working on it. That lasted a couple of years, and it was during that film that I decided I wasn't going to assist anymore, and turned down a lucrative long-term job as an assistant to prove it.
Welcome to the Hot Springs Hotel.
The problem was, and continues to be, that there is no clear line from project to project. Each time I get a job, I meet new people, but when the job ends, virtually everybody is out of work again. Each new job seems like a miracle, unrelated, largely, to anything that came before it. So when Ayn wound down, I was back on the street.
Would you stop worrying, sister dear, okay? Trust me.
Out of the blue, an acquaintance of mine, okay, it was Whitey, called up and asked if I knew how to use the Avid computer editing system. He was working on music for a straight-to-video project, and the producers needed an editor for a couple of weeks. Of course I can use the Avid, I bravely lied, and showed up for work with only the barest rudimentary understanding of what the Avid even was. Fortunately, the producers were far more incompetent than I could ever hope to be, so I was able to pick up some of the basics without revealing how little I actually knew. So impressed were they that when they got the chance to do a series for Showtime, they called me up to be not only the editor, but the entire post-production department.
Hot Springs Hotel. Hot Springs Hotel.
The pay was crap, but it would get me more experience and the credit would look good on my resume, even if the show didn't. So I agreed.
Now that was a dream.
When my friends found out that I was working on a late-night TNA series for Showtime, they were all predictably jealous. Oh, man, you get paid for looking at tits all day long. But the truth was considerably uglier than that. True, I did technically get paid for what I was doing, but I got paid very little, barely over the unemployment rate, and I was working 60 to 70 hours a week, on top of my two-hour-a-day commute. And though it's true I did get to see quite a lot of meat whistles, these were not your grade-A sweater puppies. These were the poorly enhanced knobs of frighteningly stupid wannabe starlets who somehow thought that if they flashed their fun bags on an incredibly bad late-night cable show, they would be well on their way to becoming the next Julia Roberts or Meryl Streep. Funny how there's no old bad late-night cable shows out there with Julia Roberts cavorting au naturel, or Meryl Streep suddenly shedding her top to participate in a pie fight by the pool. But this small detail seems to have escaped their attention. On the other hand, it did make me feel better about the abuse I was enduring. I may have been working long hours for little pay, but at least I got to keep my clothes on. It was a scary time. G was newly pregnant with what would become Owen, and things were tight financially. And although this job helped, it didn't help much, and I was gone so much of the day that there wasn't much of me left when I got home. I worked on this job for a couple of months over the summer, cutting 13 half-hour episodes in about 2 months. Right in the middle of that job, I turned 33. And to mark the occasion, my friend Patrick gave me the hot new Radiohead CD, OK Computer. I had heard of Radiohead before that, They had a big early alternative hit called Creep that got a lot of airplay, and their second album, The Bends, had been building up a huge fan base thanks to their year of touring behind it. The buzz was big, but in the peculiar algebra that is my musical taste, that just made me more and more resistant. That's the elitist snob in me, to be sure. Since most people are fucking idiots, the reasoning goes, then the more people that like something, the worse it must actually be. Popularity being inversely proportionate to quality. So even though the hype was unmistakable, I resisted it mightily. But since Patrick had gone to the trouble of buying me a copy of their new CD, I should at least have the decency to listen to it a couple of times before dismissing it outright. As often happens with things I end up loving, I was particularly unmoved on the first listen, and the second, and the third. And then something clicked, and I found myself getting drawn into their heavily textured sound. With three gifted guitarists at their disposal, a la The Cars, they could spin out an astonishing array of sounds. Yet they were very careful not to let the sound get muddied. And there was something in Radiohead that I hadn't heard much of lately, some real emotion. A lot of the 1980s music was about being coolly detached. Enthusiasm is so gauche. And although there was a lot of screaming going on in the grunge movement, in the 1990s there was very little actual emotionality. Sure, Kurt Cobain was pissed off, and he set the fires that burned in lots of Seattle bands, but pissed off isn't a very rich emotional context to explore, and it also doesn't exactly invite you in. Which isn't to say that it's not easy to get swept up in shared rage and frustration, but it's a very external emotion, aimed outward. Radiohead's vocalist, Tom York, didn't seem to fear confessionalism and introspection. And the band, in an astonishing revelation, actually made beautiful music. Some of the melodies and arrangements on OK Computer are absolutely drop-dead gorgeous.
Wake from your sleep. The drying of your tears. Today we escape. We escape.
Most of the music that was popular around that time reveled in its ugliness. Ugly music for an ugly world. But Radiohead wasn't afraid to construct these gorgeous musical tapestries and decorate them with heartfelt lyrics of alienation and loneliness.
Before, oh hell, breaks loose.
Their arrangements, while still capable of packing a serious punch, were often delicate and ethereal.
Breathe, keep breathing, don't lose your nerve. Breathe, keep breathing. Us a song to keep us warm.
This album, OK Computer, was the pinnacle of Radiohead's recorded output, so far anyway. It was right when the band was at their tightest, when they were experimenting with different kinds of song formats, but hadn't gone so far out that they lost their way, as they would on their subsequent albums, Kid A and Amnesiac. OK Computer was also the first album in a long time that was actually meant to be viewed as an album. It had a few relatively minor hits, but the package worked well as an entire album, all the songs fitting together to create a synergistic whole. Recording an album as more than a collection of songs is something the Beatles are credited with starting with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and it was a popular gambit for progressive bands of the 1970s, but it had fallen out of favor. Although the songs in OK Computer are about different subjects, and the mood changes are many, and all the songs stand as separate musical moments, there's something about the overall texture and sequence that makes it feel like a whole album. Or half an album, anyway. The first six songs are flawless, soaring, beautiful, without peer.
Better, happier, more productive, comfortable, not drinking too much, regular exercise at the gym, 3 days a week.
Then there's the fitter, happier poem, in which a computerized voice reads disconnected phrases of alienation and awkwardness while eerie sounds bounce around.
And saturated fats, a patient better driver, a safer car, baby smiling in backseat, sleeping well, no bad dreams, no paranoia, careful to all animals.
Entertaining a couple of times, but then forever irritating. After that, the album kind of falls apart for me. But those first six songs are priceless. They include the epic multi-part Paranoid Android, the hushed Morricone-inspired exit music for a film, which is exactly what it sounds like, the astonishingly gorgeous Subterranean Homesick Alien, and the first song to really catch my ear that summer. Although I really like the whole song, there's a moment when it explodes, and Tom York's voice soars above it all, saying, "For a minute there, I lost myself. That paralyzes me with ecstasy. Looking around at the situation in which I found myself, it's easy to see why the plaintive cry that I had lost myself seemed so compelling. Teetering on the verge of having a family, trying to get my career heading in some recognizable direction, working all day every day for idiots and for peanuts, I was in danger of losing myself entirely. So I wrapped myself in the comforting alienation of Radiohead."
This is what you get. This is what you get when you mess with us.
OK Computer was, at this writing, the halfway point of their career, and it was about the halfway point of Tom York's lyrical obtuseness. His first hit, Creep, was a chillingly accurate and easily understandable account of an awkward outsider.
When you were here before, couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You float like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so fucking special. But I'm a creep.
As the band got more and more popular, York retreated further and further into his lyrical cocoon. OK Computer is about half understandable, and then he just plunges into incoherence on the next album. Although the kind of carefully constructed nonsense that seems like it's about something and has obsessive fans poring over his lyrics, finding hidden meanings that only reveal their inner life and not Tom York's. The band seemed only too happy to follow him into the underbrush and disappear entirely from the path of coherence. Intrigued by OK Computer, I sought out their earlier releases and found that, song for song, I liked The Bends better. Their first album, Pablo Honey, is relatively weak and has the band stumbling around trying to find their niche. By The Bends, they had settled into a groove, and the songs are tight and infectious.
You confess it, but it will not come. You can test it, but it will not fall. You can crush it.
Emotional, but with a gigantic, stadium-filling sound, it's no wonder that it found such favor. The songs are better, but it, like most albums, is accidental. It's a collection of songs instead of a unified album. Radiohead also joins the swelling ranks of bands who put Head in their band name, joining such illustrious brethren as Talking Heads, Severed Heads, Tack Head, Shine Head, Teenage Head, Pale Head, Bucket Head, African Head Charge, Machine Head, Bushy Head, Medicine Head, Animal Head, Edith Head, Ultra Head, Heavy on the Head, Diamond Head, Stupid Dummy Head, and Big Head Todd and the Monsters, to name but a few.